Good evening. Welcome. I want to welcome both our audience here at San Francisco's War Memorial Opera House and our podcast listeners to San Francisco Ballet's Meet the Artist interview program this evening, Friday, May 4th, 2007. My name is Cecilia Beam, and I'm the education coordinator at San Francisco Ballet Center for Dance Education. San Francisco Ballet Center for Dance Education promotes lifelong learning and believes it's important and enriching for all of us to learn more about the art form we so love. We want our community to access the knowledge and talent that exists not only within the San Francisco Ballet, but to have experts from the field join us as well. And to that end, I'm very pleased to introduce you to our guest this evening, San Francisco Ballet's 2007 visiting scholar, Lynn Garofola. Ms. Garofola is one of the country's most distinguished dance scholars and has written and edited numerous books on dance, including Legacies of 20th Century Dance, The Ballet Russe and Its World, Dance for a City, 50 Years of the New York City Ballet, Diaghilev's Ballet Russe, and José Limón, An Unfinished Memoir. She is, among many things, a professor of dance at Barnard College in New York City and a senior editor and New York critic for Dance Magazine. Her essays and criticisms have appeared in many publications, including The Nation, Ballet Review, The New York Times, and the Los Angeles Times Book Reviews. So thank you for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
It's been so great having Lynn here. She arrived on Wednesday, did our Points of View lecture, met with the ballet students and gave a lecture. We just did a community lecture, and now we're going to spend this evening with a short interview with Lynn. So I just wanted to start off and talk a little bit about how you became a dance scholar, a dance historian, and a dance critic. Can you give us a little thumbnail sketch of the process?
Well, I don't think there was actually a process. I started out studying dance when I was a child and when I was a teenager, and then I kind of dropped it and then came back to dance as a member of the audience, a member of this wonderful world that was New York City in the 1970s. Lots and lots of ballet, all kinds of visiting companies, and lots of downtown dance. So I was really very fortunate, and in a sense, the rest is kind of history. I started showing dance films, festivals, when I was in graduate school. I started writing some criticism and decided that instead of writing a PhD thesis on the picaresque novel, I was going to do it on something to do with Diaghilev's Ballet Russe and something to do with Bloomsbury and French writers and intellectuals. And that's really how it all started.
Well, what's so wonderful about your career is it's so expansive. I mean, you work with students, you get to go to ballet and offer your thoughts about that. Can you tell us a little bit about what you find really interesting about the dance world right now, at this point in time in history?
I kind of feel we're at a transition. Most people don't, but maybe I'm an eternal optimist. I do think that something new is new things are beginning to percolate throughout the ballet field. And I think ballet, even though people say, where are the audiences? I think the audiences are going to come back. That we're in really a moment of transition with media changing very, very dramatically. Things like a podcast. This is the first time I've ever done a podcast. Things like YouTube. How can we use all of this new media to help create our new audiences of the 21st century? So I think we're in an exciting moment.
Since you've been a dance viewer and observer for so many years in dance, can you tell us about experiences you've had that have been particularly memorable or surprising?
I would say one of the things that's most memorable is sometimes when I'm talking about the past, or I'm talking especially to students, since I teach at Barnard, I have lots of students, and talking and realizing that my own memories have now become part of a historical record, in a sense, and that I'm telling them about performances that they will never see, that there's no way they can see. They weren't recorded in any way, and they're too young. But that my bearing witness through memory to something that existed, that is, you know, very... that's sort of very interesting to me. I feel I've really began looking at ballet very seriously in the 1970s at a time when I saw the last wonderful ballets of George Balanchine danced by all their original casts, as well as many older ballets that were still being danced under his watchful eye. And I feel that I was very fortunate in having seen that, and that now I'm seeing things that belong to a different era. He always used to say ballets are like butterflies, and they have sort of flown away, many of them, and what we're seeing is something different, with wonderful dancers in many instances, but something different. I feel I've seen an enormous change in technique, so that when I do see film from the 1970s, and I look at a lot of film, that I'm, you know, that this is, you know, like one and a half generations away now, maybe even two dance generations away, and there have been tremendous changes. I also am very grateful that I saw so many of the Russian defectors, the Soviet defectors in the 1970s, to have seen Baryshnikov and Mikhail Baryshnikov and Gelsey Kirkland in the early years of their partnership was something very, very special. To have seen those wonderful performances by Natalia Makarova in fairly traditional Swan Lakes and Giselles, I really feel I have a sense of the Russian classical tradition at its best, and that I was seeing performers who were not just doing tricks, although they could do some, but I was seeing some very great performers. And then I was also seeing some interest, you know, really terrific modern dance. You know, I saw, you know, so many wonderful things by Paul Taylor's company. I saw some of the last works by Martha Graham, not so wonderful, but her last real company on which she began to revive some of the really early works, and that was really fascinating to see some of those great Martha Graham works from the 1930s. Who would have thought that they would last as well as they did, and yet they did. So I feel I've seen a great deal, and that something, and that experience of the 1970s was really memorable. Oh, and I have to add, all those wonderful performances, all those wonderful ballets that Robert Joffrey brought back, and his revivals of the Diaghilev era ballets. That's where I saw Petrushka, and that's where I took lots of notes. And that's, you know, I later wrote at great length about that. I came out here to Oakland. I know I'm on the other side of the bay. I came out here to see the Oakland Ballet do Les Noces and Les Biches all the Nijinska ballets when they first did them. And when I came in to the part in my first book about called Diaghilev's Ballet Russe to write about Nijinska's work, Les Noces and Les Biches, I was pulling out all my notes from those long weekends at the Oakland Ballet because those weren't on videotape. So I feel very blessed.
That leads me to my next question. Now, you've written two books about the Ballet Russe era. Are you particularly fond of that era in ballet? Is it your favorite?
Well, I guess, had you asked me 10 years ago, I would have said it's my favorite. Now, I think it's competing with the sort of Balanchine ballet, New York City ballet of sort of the 1950s and 40s and early 60s. But I love the Ballet Russe period. I think it was an extraordinary period. so many exciting choreographers, so many exciting composers, so many exciting visual artists. I mean, when do you have the likes of a Picasso and a Stravinsky working on a ballet, which maybe was not so hot, but it had wonderful things to look at, wonderful things to hear, and that it was first I'm actually thinking about Pulcinella, which some of you may know the Stravinsky score to that, which is really wonderful, and had wonderful designs by Picasso, and choreography by Léonide Messine. So I love the collaborative idea. That doesn't always work, but I love that. And I love the idea that when you walk into the theater and you look at the stage, that it's a special place, that it's an aesthetic place. And I know in New York, when the curtain goes up on Balanchine's Prodigal Son, which most of the people in the New York City Ballet audience have seen a million times, if they've seen it once, there's still always some applause when you see the Rouault designs, and the Prokofiev music still is thrilling, and some of the choreography is still thrilling. So how Diaghilev managed to pull all that off, I'm not sure. But to me, it's still fascinating, even as I continue to admire him, at times I'm infuriated by him. There are times Diaghilev was like a mafioso. At times he was just brilliant. So, and a wonderful sentimentalist and an aesthete with a real critical intelligence.
If you're just joining us, we are in conversation with dance scholar, historian, and critic Lynn Garofola. So Lynn was telling me that she's getting on a flight tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. or something and is expected to be at the theater that night to see a New York City Ballet performance. And so I was always curious as a critic how you balance your natural desire, of course, to support and promote a company that you care so much about, but then be able to give a true evaluation. And then also how members of the public should read those evaluations and whether it should influence them or not on whether they should go see something, for example.
I think the critic has a number of obligations. One is the obligation to be informed, that is to say, to understand to the best of his or her ability what it is that is taking place in that theater. If it means something of a history of the company, a familiarity with the dancers, something about the repertoire, the artists who are contributing to the ballet or to the work. So I think the critic has a number of responsibilities. The critic also, I think, has a responsibility to make clear to the to his or her reader that what is opinion and what is descriptive. And at times, I think sometimes these two things can easily get confused. And I also feel that the critic has an obligation not to take cheap shots. Sometimes one is tempted to, very tempted, and not to get off on shticks, so to speak, because one's own words are leading you to places that perhaps are a little bit dishonest.
So what's your schedule like? Are you at the theater every night?
No. I used to be at the theater more, and then I started teaching full-time. And once I began teaching full-time, I seemed to have an awful lot of students creating theater in my office at school. I do a lot of advising. I have periods when I go to the theater more, and I'm certainly not doing as much reviewing as I used to. But I do feel the need occasionally to review. I feel the need to keep in touch with the living art. This is especially important as a historian, because I feel when I read criticism or I look at iconography or whatever is left from the past, that it's my experience as a critic of in the here and now that enables me, or at least helps me very significantly, understand what critics in the past and what observers in the past were actually writing about and describing.
I'm curious as to what you think the benefit, if there is a benefit, of ballet goers, ballet students, to make the special effort to learn about ballet history and read and get out and see as much as possible?
Well, certainly an informed audience in any realm is better than an uninformed audience. I think it's particularly important, this idea of the self-educated member of the audience is very important in dance, because you don't take dance history or dance criticism or dance appreciation in your sophomore year in high school or your sophomore year in college. This is so different from American history or American literature, English literature, which everyone studies in high school. And, of course, people tend to study much of that, some aspects of that, in college as well. Whereas dance is very different, and very often dance is merely equated with a physical activity. And I get lots of funny looks when I'm meeting some of my Columbia University colleagues, many of whom are men, and unless they've had a daughter who's danced, when I say, well, I'm in the dance department, they kind of look at me like, I can't believe we actually were having an intelligent conversation before, and now I discover you're in the dance department. So I believe there's, it really behooves us all to learn as much as we can about this art form that we love. With regard to dance students, that's harder because they really want to do it. They want to spend the time, for the most part, they want to spend the time in the studio, in performance, in class. The life of a dancer is so short. But I think some of them do get the habit of reading a little bit. And I also think it's there are those who really begin to ask questions of their teachers. Oh, where did you learn that? And I think it's also important for teachers and ballet masters to share their knowledge of the past as it relates to the ballets that are being done in the present. I think this is enormously important. And it's sort of history in the making, if you will. And I think for young dancers, advanced ballet students, that's important. I also think that just looking at dancers in the past, looking at film, looking at video, seeing what other people do, how do people interpret the role of Juliet or Romeo, this is important, I think, to enhance one's own performance ultimately.
I'm going to let you ask your questions, but before we go to that, Lynn also has a daughter who dances, and so now your daughter trained in New York, and tell us a little bit about her interest in dance and how you influenced that.
Well, she saw a lot of videos, and it's when she was about 2.5 and mimed an entire nutcracker for a dinner guest that I figured that she had had the bug. But by the time I took her to the New York City Ballet to see our local nutcracker, she had seen so many Russian nutcrackers on television that I was afraid that she would say in the middle of it, "That's not the nutcracker." So I made sure to tell her that the Nutcracker had many versions and that we were going to be seeing a different version in the theater. So I think that was something. And she was fortunate in having a mother who was a critic, because I often got an extra ticket, and she was often a guest, my date. So she was able to see an awful lot that I think otherwise she wouldn't have been able to see, so that she had a certain appreciation of the art in performance and a certain breadth. She didn't only think that that ballet was the New York City Ballet. She did know there were a lot of other dancers and a lot of other companies. Also, she could just come home and say, "Oh, so-and-so is there, you know, was teaching class. Do you know so-and-so?" And very possibly I would. So this was, you know, fun for her, you know. Mom could answer the questions.
Nice. My last question of the evening before I turn it over to the audience is oftentimes I'll go to the ballet with a family member or someone who's not very familiar with dance, and they'll turn around to me and say, you know, is it any good? You know, is it good? And I'll always turn it back to them and ask them what they thought, because I think it's important for them to start thinking about what they like. But how does somebody who's new to coming to theater develop some of those skills in appreciating dance?
I think one of the most important things is to begin to trust your own eye and also one's own response. Very often the responses come to certain dancers, that certain dancers you think are really thrilling or wonderful. Others perhaps are a little less thrilling. And try to analyze maybe why. Or if you like one, if one prefers one ballet to another, why? What is it that draws you to it? Is it the music? Very often it is music that draws people to certain works, why they find certain works more congenial. Is it the style? Is it something to do with the personalities of the dancers or or the sense of the personalities? Does it have to do with something being plotless or not plotless? But I think one has to begin to trust one's own eye and begin to use one's own mind to query what it is, and perhaps a little self-analysis, why is it that you like this? And it may turn out that what you're liking really has a lot to do with what you like in terms of movies, let's say, or in terms of music, because you know we have certain tastes that we've developed over the years, and dance will be part of that. And so I think the two things, you know, are important. And after a while, looking at films and reading about things, reading essays, reading reviews, taking them with a grain of salt, but seeing what you can learn from them, then I think you really do begin to develop not only taste, but you develop trust in your own taste and eye.
Do you open up for questions for Ms. Garofalo? Yes, sir. The question from the audience is, where can one find your reviews and articles?
Well, my reviews occasionally appear in Dance Magazine in the review columns. I write for various places. I did an interview with Mark Morris that came out a few months ago in Opera News. I have a piece, a review of Lincoln Kirstein's, the new biography of Lincoln Kirstein that will be coming out soon in The Nation in their book issue. So I write for a number of different places. My journalism, I've been doing a little less than I was doing before I was teaching.
I'm going to repeat the question. The question is, who wrote Lincoln Kirstein's biography?
It's by a historian named Martin Duberman.
The question from the gentleman is that he had heard that Stravinsky was the fourth choice to compose The Firebird. And do you know this story?
Well, I don't know if I know all four. But there were certainly at least two before Stravinsky. The first, I believe, was Leandov, who was a Russian composer who was approached to write the music. And when Diaghilev asked him, how is the music going, he said he had just gone out to buy the paper. So it didn't sound like that was much was happening. And then there was, I believe, a second one, and I'm not exactly sure. Glazunov, I don't know about that. But then eventually, in desperation, Diaghilev turned to this young composer whose work, he didn't have a great body of work behind him. Stravinsky at that point had really composed rather little. And Diaghilev had heard one of his first pieces played at a concert and thought he was interesting. And then asked him if he could do it within a certain period of time, and Stravinsky said yes, wrote madly, and it became Firebird. But I think that's part of Diaghilev's ability to tap and recognize talent.
The question is the athleticism that dancers are displaying at this point in time. The question is, do you think we've maybe maxed out now?
I don't think we will ever max out of athleticism. However, I believe at times there needs to be some control of athleticism. In other words, I don't think that higher is always better. It may be what you do in the studio, and it may increase your flexibility, but I believe there are certain ballets where a penché, an arabesque penché that goes to over 180 degrees totally destroys the design of the image and should be the dancer, in a sense, you know, should be told no. Or at times, you know, maybe the fouetté competitions that we see on stage, where we don't only get 32 fouettés, something that Diaghilev, by the way, told defending Balanchine's acrobatics in the 1929 Prodigal Son, he told an English reviewer, "You think that's acrobatics? You should see those fouettés in Soi, those fouetté turns is nothing more acrobatic than that." But I, you know, sometimes when I see, you know, people doing triples and this, and when one with the hand up this way and one with that, and then and all of that nonsense, it does seem at times that it's turning into circus. And as you know, certainly the athleticism has always, and spectacle has always been part of ballet and what attracts audiences to ballet. But I think one can go too far.
The question is, what classes do you teach at Barnard?
I teach a one-semester survey of Western theatrical dance from the Renaissance to the 1960s. It is a very rapid gallop, but I actually think we get into some interesting stuff. I teach the senior seminar in dance, where I get all the dance majors to produce in one semester a 25 to 30 page original paper, or if they do a two semester one, 50 to 60 pages, all on things about dance. I teach a course called Traditions of African American Dance. I'm going to be teaching a Russian ballet course in the fall. I teach a course on Balanchine. I've taught, I've taught a course on the Ballet Russe. So I teach, and then I teach in the general college curriculum a course called Images of the Body, Race, Class, and Gender, where we have all kinds of debates, mostly, it seems to me, about Orientalism and various other things, and where they have to do six writing assignments. So I teach a lot.
We have time for just two more questions. Yes, ma'am.
So you'd like, your question is about body types in ballet, especially for women. I would say that women have always, I would say in the last 40 years, women have been under much greater constraint to be thin, to have certain kinds of, let's say, less curvaceous bodies, and that men are not under the same constraints, and that is certainly true. I would also say that not all of it is because of ballet, but a lot of it is because of the fashion expectations of the time. If one looks through the 1960s, say Vogue, and looks at what happened to fashion, you know, fashion models, at the time when Balanchine was telling the dancers to get thinner, you had Twiggy, and you had various other models who were 85 pounds dripping wet as fashion icons. I would say today that, and this is linked a little bit to the question about athleticism, we live in a day when people spend a lot of time looking after their bodies, spend a lot of time at the gym, spend a lot of time, you know, getting all kinds of medical interventions to create the ideal body. And I think that the obsession with body types in some measure can't be in ballet, cannot be completely separated from obsessions in the culture at large.
The question is, and Lynn is just the perfect person to ask this question, is there's so many dance films over history that have introduced dance to a variety of generations. So what do you think of dance film?
Well, I think film is terrific. And I love The Red Shoes. I think it's a wonderful film with that wonderful performance by Léonide Messine. And, of course, Victoria Page, that's her name in the film, but Maura Shearer with her red hair, and numerous others. I had very mixed feelings about the Ballet Russe film, and I will share them. I will tell you why, because I'm a historian, and they got a lot of the history wrong. They didn't have a historian to sort of correct some of their dates. You know, you don't do that. But what I did love about it was having interviews with so many of those people at the end of their lives, and they seem happy. It's always nice to be around people who are happy. They, in many instances, they had very hard lives. For the most part, that generation was the especially the Russians. They had spent their early years displaced in Europe with with Nansen passports. That meant when they got to they were passports issued by the League of Nations. They were stateless, and their world was this Ballet Russe, and I think it created bonds that were so powerful. And I was actually at the gathering, the convention, the conference and gathering in New Orleans when the idea for this film either got a boost or it started there. And many of the people were actually there. And what was so impressive at one of the evening dinners, there were people who hadn't seen each other since they had left the Ballet Russe in maybe 1950. They had brought not only their children, their grandchildren, to introduce to those people. It was such a signal. It was such an important part of their lives. And so I think the joy that is in that film is something that communicates itself to the into audiences and does make people feel that, hey, dance isn't just about super athletic bodies. That it's also about the joy of communication and the joy of living in a community.
Well, we could do this for a lot longer, but our time's run out. Lynn, I want to thank you so much for coming to San Francisco Ballet. It's just been a pleasure having you.
In my pleasure. Thank you.
And I want to remind our audience, you can find out more about all of our education programs and listen to this and other podcasts by visiting the San Francisco Ballet website at sfballet.org. Good night and enjoy the program.